A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the History of Byzantium, episode 178, questions 7. As I mentioned last episode, today we deal with your inquiries with more of an imperial flavour. Off we go. Listener MR asks how the provincial administration operated in 1025. How would a peasant interact with the government at this level? And which officials would control the affairs of a town, and what responsibilities would they have? Now, we've talked already in detail about the administration of the newly conquered provinces, so this will just refer to the older themes covering Greece, Thrace, and Anatolia. Once upon a time, the strategos had been the man in charge of all matters in his province, but by 1025, most had been returned just to their military duties. The provincial or theme judge was now in charge of financial and judicial matters. In theory, this meant greater control by Constantinople, as they could send their man to run a particular area. But in practice, anyone going to live in a theme would have to contend with the local elites and would get little done without their cooperation. In some cases, this job was divided still further, with a Crites, responsible for civil administration and justice, a Protonotorius, looking after fiscal administration, and a Chartularios, looking after military registers and pay. The few glimpses we get of actual provinces in action show a variation on this formula each time. So the arrangements, as with so many things in Byzantium, were not consistent and depended on a variety of factors. For the average farmer, the main interaction with government was the payment of tax. Some paid rent to a landlord and therefore wouldn't need to pay any, but most had to contribute something. In theory, this was worked out on the land registers, but in practice it was almost impossible for the government to keep track of who owned what and who was working which piece of land and how many animals they had. So usually some kind of intermediary would negotiate with the government on your behalf. This might be an elected village headman, or it might be a local notable. And this could be just the richest person in your area, or it might be a government official, or an ex-official, or a clergyman, or the head of a monastery. Again, everything was based on local arrangements and past precedent. And this tangle is why the government wanted to stop the elites from acquiring more land. It was far easier to intimidate individual farmers or independent villages into paying than it was the wealthy. Tax collectors were usually accompanied by a detachment of troops from the theme HQ, which gives you some idea of the relationship between taxpayers and the government. The headquarters of a theme were usually located in an urban centre, and responsibility for the operations of this town or city again varied from place to place. A strong strategos might dictate affairs, where in other places the local bishop might take the lead. The civil administrators had the authority to regulate town affairs, but if they were outsiders, they might defer to local power brokers to make key decisions. Hence the importance of bishops who usually served for long periods and so would be known to everyone and hopefully be trusted. In other places with no officials present, wealthy local families would take charge of affairs. Most urban centres were still fairly small and unwalled, so the responsibilities for those in charge would be to ensure fair trade was taking place and regulate crime and other disputes. At Laodicea in Syria, one visitor reports that during his stay, the major political issue of the day was the regulation of the city's prostitutes. In the larger cities which maintained walls or bridges, then work crews and garrisons would need to be organised and paid, and gates locked at the end of each day. Listener MR also asked about ducats and catapanets, as you may read them on maps from 1025 and around. A duke's and a catapan were military titles. The records kept by the palace refer to the ducat of Mesopotamia, but they mean the military command of Mesopotamia, rather than implying that a ducat was a different kind of province from a theme. This is one of the reasons that I named one of the end of the century episodes, Don't Believe Your Maps. What modern map makers have done is slap names on each new area of territory taken from the name of the military command that was established at the time. But as time passed, many of these commands disappeared, and as you now know, down on the ground, the locals were running their own affairs. So if you see the ducat of this or the catapanet of that, it doesn't refer to different types of governance, merely the title of the military governor with overall responsibility for the area. Listener DV also asked if there were boundary markers delineating the borders of themes, like the old Limes inscriptions from the earlier empire. Which is a great question, but I assume the answer is no. As we recently discussed, no mile markers have been found from the Byzantine era, and since the theme boundaries were changed several times over the centuries, I think we can assume that nothing formal was put in place. And given the annual raids on Anatolia, it's easy to understand why. Listener SS asks, how did the Byzantine attitude towards trade and merchants compare with attitudes in the Republic or the Principate? And how did they compare to attitudes in Western Europe? This is another issue that we discussed in the recent Backer Rewards episode. Denied the security of land ownership, the elites of Northern Italy turned to trade and commerce and benefited from the absence of Byzantine merchants in the East. Now, I haven't studied Western Europe specifically, but I suspect a similar dynamic was at work in the towns of the future Netherlands and England, and then on to many other places, that men who were denied the chance to become part of the landed gentry would increasingly look to the seas to make the necessary money to break into the elite. In Byzantium, this remained unnecessary so long as the government could collect tax and redistribute the proceeds to their wealthiest citizens. I also haven't studied the Principate or the Republic in detail, but I know that the origins of this dismissive attitude towards trade began back then. Land ownership was the basis on which men were included in the Senate, and those like Crassus, who made a fortune through business, did not win respect for doing so. Listener AL says, do we know the relative size of the economies and armies of the empire's neighbours? Would a Roman still think he's living in the most powerful country in Europe? That last part of the question comes up every century, and I think the answer is no, not anymore. Even with the collapse of the Caliphate and the Carolingians, I think the fact of their rise had made it clear to educated Byzantines that the empire no longer possessed power that others lacked. You know, the Venetians down in the harbour have better ships, the Syrian silk merchants have better wares, the Varangian mercenaries are tougher. Anyone thinking seriously about it would have concluded that Byzantium was part of a multipolar world. But on a personal prejudice level, educated Romans continued to believe, as they always had done, that they were the guardians of true civilization, and nothing that they saw in the lives of Western Europeans or Muslims changed that point of view. And thanks to the size and scale of Constantinople and the amount of gold coins that the palace could command, they had good reason to still think that they were the wealthiest and best, assuming they hadn't travelled far enough afield to Baghdad or wherever to get a true sense of perspective. As for the relative population sizes, we talked about this a bit in Backer Awards episode 10. I can't tell you about the Pechenegs or Hungary or, you know, countries with no records and places without states. But Byzantium certainly had a larger population than all of its near neighbours. And again, I think those thinking about it would have had a sense that if you move far enough away, if you move into Germany, if you move towards Egypt or towards Iran, there are population centres there that are just as big as Byzantium. And so again, if for those with that sense of perspective, it would have been clear that this was a multipolar world and that the idea of the Roman Empire as the preeminent power would have changed. You know, people's sense of how big the world was and how important they were in it, you know, was very different back then. They didn't have globes to look at. Even, you know, the most educated who could see an old map, I don't think it would have been fully clear how small Byzantium was compared to all the land masses and the peoples around it. But I think just in general that the essence of that question is asking, do Romans still think like the Romans of old, who genuinely thought we are masters of the world and the world beyond it is pure barbarism? No, I don't think that existed amongst anyone thinking about it in 1025. Listener Jay points out that Byzantium was being pulled in two directions. On one side you had the Magnates pushing east, and on the other Basil II moving west into the Balkans. Could the Magnates have driven east and established independent Christian kingdoms in the Levant, similar to what happened a century later with the Crusades? After all, there were still Christian populations in the area at the time. Yes and no. Yes, it's possible that a Roman leader could have marched into Syria, captured a couple of cities, and decided to stay outside of the jurisdiction of the empire. But no, it didn't happen, and there are several reasons why. One is that soldiers served in Byzantium for pay. Many came from homes in Anatolia that they expected to return to, while others were mercenaries from even further afield. So at what point would a commander inform them that he planned on relocating them permanently to the Levant? The only way I can see that working is if the general annexed some territory and then released most of his army to go home, and then used the revenue of the new area to recruit mercenaries. This would have been a very precarious position, because as we've talked about, since that question was asked, most of the Christians of the Caliphate viewed the Byzantines as more foreign than the Arabs at this point. Those Christians had been living peacefully side by side with Muslims for centuries, so I don't see why they would have thrown in their lot with a Byzantine adventurer who would have become a natural target for other Muslim states in the region. That would have been very risky. The Crusaders were in quite a different position. They'd come specifically to conquer, and many of their leaders were actively looking, once they were there, to carve out fiefdoms for themselves. So they were equipped psychologically in particular, to stay and make a go of it. Whereas for most Byzantines, life outside the empire was inconceivable. They'd been taught their whole lives that they were essentially a chosen people, the only ones with the correct relationship with God, and that everyone else were heretics or barbarians. And so in practice, even defeated rebels didn't flee the empire. Bardas Skliros came before Basil II and asked if he could be honorably retired. And so as not to alienate Skliros's many friends and relatives, Basil agreed. Now, with leniency like that, there wasn't great incentive for men to leave the empire to try and make their fortune and fame. You know, if anyone had that level of ambition, they would look to the throne of Constantinople. They weren't going to imagine the effort it would take to carve out a kingdom elsewhere if they could get the real prize. And for those with ambition and wanting to grow rich, there was so much land available within Romania that still could be colonized that it just wasn't worth looking at foreign fields. Listener MR says, you mentioned that Basil II gave new families power in Anatolia. Who were these families? Were one of these the Komnenos family? There are two things here. One is the movement of Armenian elites into Anatolia that we talked about in episode 170 and 171. And the other is indeed the promotion of other Byzantine families at the expense of the Phokas, Korkuas, and Skliros clans. And this certainly included the Komnenos family. Manuel Komnenos, grandfather of Alexius, was one of Basil's keenest supporters during the civil wars. And when he died, he entrusted his children's education to Basil, who made sure that they were brought up within the army and given command experience. The generation of men that Basil promoted will become leading characters in our narrative going forward. And this includes the Bringas family, the Archiros family, the Dalasinoi, the Thukas family, the Dukai as you read them, the Botiniatai and the Diogeni. More information and better pronunciation when we get to them. Speaking of Byzantine families, listener MR asks whether they had their own banners and mottos, as many Western European houses did. The quick answer is no. The longer one is that this type of heraldry, as you point out, was more of a Western European phenomenon. Born in a culture of weaker government, where the history of individual families was more important to politics. In Byzantium, service for the state had always been more important than family prestige. The past century of warfare in the borderlands had changed that a little, but the danger in Byzantium is that those with a great name would be put up by others to lead rebellions. And with the state's ability to snuff out a family's fortunes with the stroke of a pen, it was much harder for great houses to be maintained. Heraldry will increase in popularity as contacts with the West grow stronger over the next couple of centuries. Listener DV asks a similar question about whether the empire used other symbols in military situations. Evidence is a little thin, but of course we know about the labarum and the use of the cross in general as a military symbol. We also have several stories of icons being used at the head of the army. Images from icons are also attested on the seals of officials, suggesting that some adopted their local saint's likeness as a sort of family crest. We also know that units in the army would have symbols or patterns that they put on banners or shields as a mark of pride. A couple of questions about diplomacy next. Listener E.T. asks whether there were concerted efforts to forge an alliance with the Caliphate of Cordova over in Spain. And listener DC asks how frequently embassies went back and forth between the Byzantines and the Fatimids. As far as I know, embassies were an ad hoc arrangement. We hear about the major ones, where particular officials and clergymen are carefully selected to go and meet neighbouring heads of state. And I haven't read anything that implies that there were regular lower-level embassies going on in the meantime. I think in the case of the Fatimids, communication was done through local proxies. Byzantium and the Egyptian caliphate didn't share a border, so they could communicate through the various Syrian city-states like Aleppo, who were their clients. As for Cordova, the Byzantines became interested in relations with Spain when Sicily was first invaded. Theophilus made great efforts to get on friendly terms, but nothing concrete was agreed, and then contacts were renewed again when the invasion of Crete was being planned. But again, as far as I know, no regular relations were established. It just doesn't seem to have been that important to have regular contact with neighbouring states. By the way, listener E.T. was prompted to ask that question because he visited modern Cordoba and was shown a room which the caliphs reserved for the reception of ambassadors from Byzantium. But the history of palaces suggests that many rooms were designed for high-level events, which were rarely used. A listener D.C. also stepped in to answer a previous listener question. In a past roundup, someone asked whether contact was maintained with the Christian Kingdom of Ethiopia, once the caliphate arrived, and the answer seems to be no, but the Egyptian Patriarchate continued to provide clergy for the African church over the centuries, and records show the right of travel between the two being negotiated with the caliphs over the years. Listener RK asks about the religious beliefs of the Varangian Guard. Were they recruited from Christian communities, or did they take all comers? They took all comers. The outsider status of the Varangians meant there was no need for them to be Orthodox believers. They weren't going to hold an office of state, which would put them in a position to embarrass anyone. The Varangians were asked to take part in palace ceremonies, though, which were overtly Christian in nature, but this doesn't seem to have been a problem for either side. Some records hint at a church being put aside for Varangian use, which may have become more relevant as the guard recruited from Russia or Britain or other places where Christianity was practiced, but there was no barrier to entry for pagans. A listener RK asks if the upcoming Great Schism caused problems for guardsmen recruited from Catholic lands, and I'm fairly confident the answer is no, in part because the Great Schism, as we'll discover, was not so great, or at least it would not have been apparent to the average person that a significant break had occurred, and, to put it bluntly, if you were willing to leave your home to kill people for money, I don't think you're going to be too concerned about issues of ecclesiastical divergence. Listener AK asks, when do you believe was the last opportunity for the Byzantines to re-establish the Roman Empire of old at its greatest length? He mentions East and West in his question, and I'm afraid the last chance for either was way before 1025. Probably the mid-5th century in the West, and, basically within 10 years of losing the Battle of Yarmouk, unless the Arabs could have been counterattacked immediately, while the Sassanids did the same, then I don't see a way back for the Empire. I would urge listener AK to re-listen to the end-of-century episodes I produced in 976 AD. There just weren't enough men in the Empire to mount campaigns much beyond Aleppo. And if men could be found, the culture of aggressive warfare was not really shared by the people of Constantinople during this time. And if you could overcome those barriers and find enough men to fight and find enough money to pay them and find a spirit of real conquest somehow within the political framework of Byzantium, you would then have united the Muslim world against you. And that, of course, would have then required opening up different fronts and recruiting more men with more money. And it's just not practical. I'm afraid too many variables would have needed to change for a Byzantine-led reconquest to be remotely plausible. Related to this, listener JJ asks, since there is now a clear east and west to the empire, did anyone think about dividing rule over it in two, like the old Eastern and Western Roman Empire? Yes, this was proposed. Over the centuries, this comes up occasionally when an emperor has two sons or something like that, but I don't think it was ever seriously considered. You know, recently in our narrative, Bardas Phocas offered this deal to Bardas Scleros. You know, I'll rule from Constantinople and take the west, you run the east. But when they actually met, Phocas imprisoned Scleros. I don't think anyone really wanted to share the job of emperor. You know, Basil II kept his own brother out of politics for 50 years to make sure that there would be no attempts to overthrow him from any direction. And the history of the empire suggests that he was right to do so. Sadly, this is a recurring pattern across Roman history. Some of the most fruitful periods of rule have seen two men sharing power to some extent. You know, Augustus and Agrippa, Diocletian and Maximian, Justinian and Belisarius, and more recently, Romanus Lecapenus and John Corcuas. But sadly, these partnerships are rare or short-lived. Absolute power leads to suspicion and paranoia and plenty of usurpation attempts which prove that you were right to be suspicious and paranoid all along. You know, and part of all this is the absolute necessity of keeping control of Constantinople. That made power sharing very hard to fathom, because whoever was outside the capital would be at a distinct disadvantage. Listener DRU asked, what happened to the territory of Illyria, which provided so many illustrious emperors in the past? I haven't heard it mentioned in your narrative. Is it part of what you mean by Western Bulgaria now? There are various different definitions of what Illyria or Illyricum included, but generally speaking, we're talking about the old provinces of Dalmatia and Pannonia, both of which fell out of the Roman orbit a long time ago. In 1025, Dalmatia is the home of Serbian and Croatian mini-states. The Bulgarian state that Basil just defeated was situated a little further south in the Macedonian mountains. Listener DRU implies in his question that Illyria was once a prosperous place, but I don't think it particularly was. The reason it produced so many emperors was because it was a prime recruiting ground for the nearby Danube legions. Listener MR would like to know more about imperial regalia and the coronation ceremony. Now, we may well revisit this again in the future, but for now, go check out episode 77, where we went with Irene from her arrival in the capital to her wedding and installation as empress. Finally, listener RO asks, which emperors are now the top five best and the top five worst? When we get to 1453, I will take this question very seriously and do a thorough analysis. But for now, I will just reel them off with no explanation and not too much thought. From fifth to first, worst, Irene, Justinian II, Phocas, Basiliscus, and Justin II. From fifth to first best, Romanus Lecapenus, Leo III, Basil II, Heraclius, Anastasius. Thank you all so much for your questions. The next episode you hear will be a Backer Rewards episode about the Empire's Jewish communities, which will also feature some of your end-of-the-century questions on the same topic. Then we will have a little recap and preview episode to get your mind in gear for the narrative. Then the narrative resumes.